coming to you from our mysterious underground laboratories in Athens, Ohio and Madison, Wisconsin. We have shark expert David Schiffman on today's episode of Stop, Think, Science.
People are afraid of them. When people hear that 24% of all species of sharks and their relatives are threatened with extinction, a lot of people's reaction is, good, what can we do to make it 100% of them threatened with extinction?
You are listening to Stop, Think, Science. Please buckle your seatbelts and put your tray tables in the upright position. You are about to embark on a journey through science and technology. Get ready to learn and expand your mind. Are you ready?
Welcome to Stop, Think, Science. My name is Ian, and today on the podcast, Greg is joining me.
Hi, everyone. How are you doing?
Our expert guest today is David Schiffman, who is currently a PhD candidate at the University of Miami's ABES Center for Ecosystem Science and Policy. He's studying shark biology and conservation. In his professional career, David has dedicated himself to educating others about sharks, marine biology, and ocean conservation through scientific outreach. He has blogged for SouthernFriedScience.com since 2009, which is one of the most widely read ocean science blogs on the internet, and has conducted numerous talks for school and community groups in Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, New York, and Pennsylvania. In recognition for his dedication to teaching others all about the ocean, he was named the Marine Science Educator of the Year in 2014 by the Florida Marine Science Educators Association. Sharks matter, and David's here to tell us today why he thinks that is. So welcome, David. We'd like to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ian and Greg.
So first of all, did we miss anything from the intro or anything you want to add?
No, that's a very thorough intro.
Great.
I did some research on your website, so I read up all about you.
Lucky you.
Typical of previous episodes, we ask kind of just a general question to start it off. Imagine you're sitting on an airplane flying to a conference, but the person sitting next to you in seat 2A doesn't have a scientific background. In about 60 seconds, how do you describe what you do on a daily basis?
I don't have to imagine that because I've actually had that experience about 15 times on the way to conferences. But I'm a scientist studying how sharks affect the ecosystem in coastal Florida, and by extension, what will happen to the ecosystem when sharks aren't there anymore. And I also am very involved in talking to members of the public and other stakeholders about these issues.
Great. So you researched sharks, but how did you first become interested in science? Was there any particular experience that sticks out in your memory?
Interested in science specifically? No, I've been interested in sharks as long as my family can remember. I feel like most little kids go through a shark thing or a dinosaur thing, and I actually had both of those. Approaching it a different way, you read enough about it, you watch enough documentaries about it, you spend enough time at zoos and science museums, and it just sort of sinks in. And my family has always been very supportive of my career goals. I think they, until about college, I think they assumed I was going to grow out of it at some point and become a lawyer or a doctor or something, but they've always been very supportive. And at this point, my mom, my dad, and my brother, and my fiance have all been out on the shark research boat with me, so they get to see what I do hands-on.
Oh, that's really cool. So I do remember reading on a little bit of your background information that the Discovery Channel's program Shark Week had a role potentially in your scientific upbringing, I guess.
It did. I grew up in Pittsburgh, pretty far from the ocean. And again, I just read every book I could get my hands on. I spent lots of time at the Pittsburgh Aquarium, where I later worked for a summer in college. And I watched every documentary I could find on TV, and Shark Week was a source of high-quality natural history and behavior and science programming about sharks at the time that I was growing up. And now, after the last few years, they've been sort of moving away from that and into the realm of pseudoscience, though this last year was definitely a step back in the right direction.
Right. So you publicly, on Twitter at least, have been trying to call them out on this, I guess, and trying to make it well known to the public that this programming isn't as scientifically based as they might think. Why specifically did you think that was important to confront them about?
Well, Shark Week represents the greatest temporary increase in public paying attention to any ocean science or conservation issue of the year. Millions of people watch Shark Week. For many of them, it's their only exposure to sharks that doesn't come from news, the occasional news story when they're flipping through channels. So I think it's important that people get it right, because sharks are a very misunderstood group of animals, and many species are very threatened from a conservation perspective. And if you, one of many obstacles to protecting threatened species of sharks is people are afraid of them. When people hear that 24% of all species of sharks and their relatives are threatened with extinction, a lot of people's reaction is, good, what can we do to make it 100% of them threatened with extinction? But really, they're a very ecologically and economically important species or group of animals, and we need to make sure to protect them. And a big part of that is educating people about what's really going on.
Yeah, and I think at least in popular knowledge through film potentially, as well as these programs on the television, it seems like not necessarily that fear mongering is going on, but that it's probably a popular opinion, I might conjecture, that people are afraid of sharks. And so to go into a little bit more depth, why should people care about sharks, and why should people care that they're present as a part of our ocean's ecosystem?
Well, predators are always important in keeping ecosystems in balance to varying degrees, depending on what ecosystem you're talking about. Where I'm from, outside of Pittsburgh, we used to have wolves. Then we killed the wolves because wolves are scary and wolves are bad. And now there's too many deer. And there's not enough food for all the deer, and there's not enough space for all the deer. So the deer are malnourished, the deer are sick, and the deer go to places they wouldn't ordinarily go, like people's backyards or right next to the road, and they cause a great deal of property damage and also spread Lyme disease. So there, and people often say in response to that, well, but we hunt deer. Yes, humans do hunt deer, but wolves go for the sick and the weak and the dying and the young. Whereas hunters go for the biggest and strongest and most impressive looking deer to make a good trophy. And that has very different evolutionary and ecological effects. And the same type of thing can happen in the ocean. Sharks help keep the food web in balance. And the food web associated with coastal oceans employs millions of people, provides food for millions of people, and as well as recreation. So it's important that we keep everything healthy.
I think both Greg and I actually have experience with that as well. We're both from Pennsylvania, so we've both seen firsthand that deer definitely are overpopulated, and that is in large part based on the conservation practices that have been put into place. But you mentioned that sharks are at the top of the food chain.
Many species are. Well, there are a lot of small and medium species of sharks, and many sharks when they're babies are prey. But yes, in general, the larger species of sharks are typically the top of their food chain.
So I guess I'll back up. There are different sizes of sharks. People, when they watch movies, they always think of Jaws, where we're thinking great white sharks. There are a lot of types of sharks. Would you like to talk about some of the different biodiversity of sharks and what kind of sharks there actually are?
There are more than 512 species of sharks recognized by science as of 3 weeks ago when I asked the chair of the IUCN Shark Specialist Group Taxonomy Group so I could give a right answer for shark trivia at the museum. So there are at least 512 species. Most people can name maybe 5 or 10. The only ones you ever hear about are the ones that bite people, like bull sharks or great white sharks. But there are many species of sharks that they're adapted to a huge variety of ecosystems. Some live under Arctic ice. Some live in the deepest parts of the ocean. Some live in fresh water. Some live in coral reefs. Some live there's an old joke among the Coast Guard folks that if the way to tell if there is a shark in the water is put your hand in the water and taste the water, and if it's salty, there's probably sharks in the water. they're just about everywhere, and they're incredibly well adapted to being a part of their environment. What they're not well adapted for is humans and modern industrial fishing technology.
So what differentiates a shark between other large fish with teeth?
Well, sharks, skates, rays, and chimeras are evolutionarily distinct from something like a tuna or a mahi-mahi or a largemouth bass or others fish like that that are called the bony fishes. Those have bone skeletons similar to what mammals have. Sharks, skates, rays, and chimeras have a cartilaginous skeleton similar to what's in our ears or noses. So it's much more flexible. It's much lighter. That's the main difference, but there are other features as well. The shark, skates, rays, and chimeras have some extra sensory abilities that most species of other fish don't have. And also their life history is different from most other species of fish. It can take a sandbar shark more than 10 years to reach reproductive maturity, at which point they'll have two, three, four, five, six babies every 2 or even 3 years. Compare that to something like a mahi-mahi, that it takes them only a few years to reach reproductive maturity, and then they'll have tens or hundreds of thousands of eggs multiple times a year, and you can see how overfishing becomes a problem really quickly. The sharks are just not adapted to recover their populations quickly like other species of fish are.
So you mentioned a lot about how sharks, or what kind of sharks there are. What's the typical day of research look like for you? What do you guys do? I imagine you guys go out on a boat. What does that look like?
Well, we are out on the boat about 60 to 75 days a year. One of the nice things about being in South Florida is the weather here means that animals are here year round. Other places, they have a field season. Here, our field season is the whole year. And most weekends during the academic year, we're out on the boat. We leave just right from Miami, go out on day trips. Every trip, we bring a group with us, usually a local high school class, but sometimes community organizations or even companies or even private individuals that want to participate. And we go out, we deploy our shark. The first thing you have to do when you're doing research with sharks is get the sharks. So we deploy our fishing gear, which is called a drum line. We have 10 drum lines. A drum is about a 50-pound concrete weight connected by a long length of line to a float on the surface. And then also connected to the weight, which sits on the bottom, is a long length of line and a baited hook. So these are not – they're 10 independent units of fishing gear. They're not connected to each other. They're not connected to the boat. And we deploy these. We wait. We check – and we check each of them 3 times. And if there's no shark on there, and we will rebait the hook and put it back out. If there is a shark on there, we have a research workup where we're taking data for about a dozen ongoing scientific research projects, many of which are very important from a conservation and management perspective. We take a variety of detailed measurements of the animals. We take blood. We take a skin sample. We take, for some species, we take a muscle sample. And for some, we put a GPS satellite telemetry tag on them. So whenever the fin breaks the surface, we get an email telling us exactly where it is anywhere in the world. And we've had our sharks swim thousands and thousands of miles, which is important information if you're trying to protect them. You need to know where they are. And at the end of the day, we just take the samples home and put them in the freezer. All of our research is 100% catch and release, non-lethal, minimally invasive, designed to be as stress-free to the animals as possible. And our guests get to participate in every step of it. They help with the fishing, they help with the research workup, and they learn about science and they learn about their local marine environment and local conservation issues.
Now, specifically with a mixed audience, as you said, you take school groups and other groups out on the boat. Do you have to be careful with your protocols with handling the sharks that you catch and for safety as well as for the well-being of the sharks, as you mentioned?
Yes. The short answer is yes. We are very careful with our training protocols. We have a team of undergraduate interns and master student interns that are very well trained, and they are the ones who are securing the shark. And then our guests get to go in and take the measurements and take the samples and things like that. And we show them how to do that in advance. It takes us about 20 minutes to explain how to do all the research workups and practice them. And then our goal is, from when we catch the shark to when we release the shark, should be less than 5 minutes. So we say it's like a NASCAR pit crew where everyone has their job and everyone has their tool and you're waiting. And as soon as it's your turn, you go and get out of the way. But one of my favorite stories with the risk assessment associated with this, we have to work with a lot of school districts and universities and their insurance and risk people to convince them that this is in fact a very safe activity. And there was one group that almost at the last minute had to pull out because their university's insurance was saying that you cannot put students in an environment like this. It's obviously unsafe. And they came out with us and were totally fine. They had a great day, no problems at all. And then they went, their next stop after being with us was to a swim with the dolphins place in the Florida Keys. And one of their people got bitten by a dolphin.
Oh my gosh. Well, that isn't ironic. So are there any specific, I guess if your typical day, I assume there's some office work as well, although we probably won't touch on that because being out in the boat.
Most of what I do is answer email and put data into an Excel spreadsheet. But
mm-hmm. So as far as the overall picture of your work that you do, are there any major challenges that are inherent to that research that you have to overcome or have overcome already in your project?
The two biggest challenges that we face doing field work with threatened species is A, it's expensive. Even though it's right in Miami and we don't have to travel, I can drive to my field site in 15 minutes. It's still expensive to use the boat for the day. So we can't get, scientists would always love to have more data, but there's limits to how much data you can get with the available boat time that we have. So that's a major issue with marine science field work in general. People studying like forest ecology, they can just walk and do forest ecology. We have to get boat time, and that can be very expensive. And the other major problem is that many of the species we're trying to get data on are threatened, which means there aren't very many of them anymore. So it's hard to get a sample size enough to answer the questions that we need. But I think, done a pretty good job of getting around both of those issues.
Do you guys take data points for other things that might influence the sharks, like water temperature or?
Absolutely. Yes. We take a variety of environmental data as well as time of day, which is in sort of related to tide at one of our field sites. So, yes. And we've found that there's not a huge relationship there, but there certainly one major pattern that we found that shark researchers basically around the world have found that if there was a storm that day or the day before, you're not going to catch much. The animals go deep and offshore, or at least many species do, if there's a change in the air pressure, the barometric pressure. So other than that, Sharknado was pretty realistic.
Is there any research being done to see how things like global warming or the increase in, say, hurricanes are impacting sharks in the ocean?
Well, there was a very thorough study that came out a couple of years ago that a colleague of mine did about an ecological risk assessment of Australian sharks from the perspective of climate change. And the short answer is climate change is not going to be really great for anything, but it's not a major threat to most shark species, because often what you see with fish is if the water temperature changes, they just adjust their range slightly to an area where where the water temperature is more suitable. And that might have a variety of other ecological effects, because where they shift their range to might have an entirely different ecosystem. But for the animals themselves, it's probably climate change is not going to do many of them in, except for the freshwater or brackish species that can't move because they're isolated to a particular area. Overfishing is by far the greatest threat facing sharks overall.
I believe you pride yourself well on being an excellent scientific communicator.
That's the goal.
So what are your goals as a science communicator? What are you trying to accomplish with your outreach on shark conservation?
Well, again, sharks are a very misunderstood taxa, and people are afraid of them. People think that if they dip their toe in the bathtub, a shark is going to eat their whole family. And it's really not the case, and that attitude is harmful towards public policy making about shark conservation. So I would like for people to know that, yes, sharks are wild predators, and every once in a while they do cause injury or even death to humans, but they're not evil monsters. They're not vicious. They're not hunting you down. And in fact, they're helpful to the ecosystem and to coastal economies and are in trouble. So if everyone would understand those things, then I would have a lot less to talk about, and that would be okay with me.
So the major challenge there, I guess, is just getting over previous misconceptions that people have.
Yes. Nobody doesn't know what a shark is, which is kind of amazing. You talk to probably some of your other guests, they have to just explain what their study system is. But nobody doesn't know what a shark is, at least for the most part in the U.S. Everyone and people have lots of opinions on them, and they have their personal theories on them. I can't tell you all the ridiculous pet theories that people email me. But so my problem with many threatened species, first you need to get people to know, hey, here's what a vaquita is, because most people probably don't know what a vaquita is. But with sharks, I don't have to tell them what it is. I have to tell them, hey, everything you think you know about them is actually wrong and harmful. It's a completely separate set of challenges.
Well, and specifically working in conservation as you do, that's even more important, because you're trying to you have those research challenges that you're working with your subjects that are disappearing on you for various reasons related to human interaction, as well as just I guess probably mostly related to human interaction with them. Mm-hmm. But then you're also working with the problem that you need to try and turn that around, and need to help somehow find out what's going on to help these species continue to perpetuate themselves.
Exactly.
So yeah, I don't know where I'm going from here.
it's a mix of talking to the public and public outreach and education, as well as research and working with natural resource managers. Mm-hmm.
So I have kind of a question that's a little bit out of sync, I guess, but
sure.
In the biological field, there's a lot of talk right now, or there has been for a while, about mercury in aquatic systems. I don't know if it's more so in like freshwater systems such as the Great Lakes, but do you guys do any types of studies to see if there's any magnification of the mercury in the sharks, or if there's any impact on the sharks?
There are issues with biomagnification. As you go higher up the food web, things get concentrated, as you guys know, and that's definitely an issue with top predators. There are species of sharks that have been found with very high levels of mercury in their meat. I believe the FDA issues advisories advises that pregnant women limit how much shark and tuna and other and swordfish and other top predators they eat because of that. There are. To my knowledge, there's no evidence that the level of mercury in their meat is harmful to them, but it's not great for humans to regularly consume because of that.
And then there's recently in the news, there's been a big thing about shark fins. So I guess that's considered poaching. How does that, I guess, shark fin trade affect the populations of sharks?
So there actually is a significant legal shark fin trade. There is poaching and illegal fishing, but there is a significant legal fin trade, including in the U.S. The fins of sharks have these cartilage fin ray elements called ceratotrichia, and if you dry them and boil them, they sort of make a noodle-like substance, and that is made into a traditional Chinese delicacy. And it used to be that only the emperor and his court would eat that delicacy. But since the 1980s, with economic liberalization in China, you have millions and millions of newly wealthy people that want to demonstrate that they're wealthy by showing traditional signs of wealth from their culture. So that has led to an enormous demand for shark fins. And in many cases, it's an unsustainable demand. Though the U.S. shark fishery, as well as that from Canada, Australia, and parts of Europe, there are sustainable shark fisheries, but there's a lot of unsustainable shark fisheries. And the fin trade is a major driver. It used to be the biggest driver by far. It's not really anymore. There's a growing trade in shark meat, particularly in South and Central America. There's a growing market for shark meat, and in parts of Europe, skate and ray meat are getting very popular. In parts of Australia and I think the United Kingdom, if you get fish and chips from a cheap fish and chips shop, you're probably eating shark.
Oh wow.
If you ever go to, like, not Long John Silver specifically, but sort of that quality of seafood in the U.S. and you get fried scallops, it's often ray. So there is a major economic exploitation of these animals, which is not always sustainably managed, and in some cases is very unsustainably managed.
I mean, does any of that fishing happen locally near your research sites, or do you ever run into these kind of people?
There are shark fishermen here in Florida.
What is their reaction to you?
We don't work too closely with them, though there have been times when they've caught some of our tagged animals, and they're generally kind enough to return the tag to us and give us information about the animal that it was caught on. But the U.S. shark fishery is reasonably well managed. We don't have a huge issue with them for the most part. Mm-hmm. There are certainly elements of the U.S. commercial fishery that we would prefer alter their practices to reduce mortality of threatened species.
I mean, do you think that I don't know what your future career plans are, but do you think that there could be a future in policy there? Maybe not for you, but for other people that are passionate about this kind of research.
There are definitely careers in policymaking in the shark world. I think one of your Twitter folks had a question about what advice would I have for someone who wanted to make a career in conservation. And the first thing I say is it depends what exactly you mean by conservation. If you want to do what I do, which is make scientific research that helps support conservation and management plans, that's a very different career from being a natural resources manager who implements those plans or being an environmental activist who lobbies for different plans. So there's a huge range, and they all have different goals and they all have different requirements. But what you can do for any of them is learn about them, and social media can be a very powerful tool to do that. Also, if at all possible, attending scientific conferences is an incredibly valuable way to learn about careers. Particularly an interdisciplinary one that has natural resources managers and environmental activists there.
I think that sums that section up nicely. We have a few minutes left here, and so we'd kind of like to segue into a little bit more about you. So
you're
a scientist and a conservationist, and typically science, I guess you're not technically in a lab. I guess the ocean is your lab, but most scientists have some moments where things didn't go exactly as planned, maybe call it a worst moment. Go ahead and tell us about a time when something just didn't work exactly how you wanted it to.
Well, my favorite story with this is the first time I took my dad out on the boat with me after years of me telling him, no, Dad, sharks really aren't that dangerous. No, I wouldn't be safer if I went to law school. The first trip he got to go on with me, he ended up taking me to the hospital. Not because of a shark, but because I messed up deploying the fishing gear and got a shark hook through my hand. And shark hooks are not small. The dock in the box facility did not actually have a tool large enough to remove the hook from my hand. So one of the nurse's aides had to go to their home and borrow a set of giant bolt cutters from their husband.
Oh my gosh.
But believe it or not, I was invited back on the research boat the next week.
So this is when you were in graduate school?
That was in the first summer of my master's, my first field season. And I actually still have that hook in a medical waste jar on my desk here to remind me. Sharks aren't dangerous, but you need to, when you're working with them, you need to be paying attention. You need to respect them. And if you forget to respect your study system or your gear or your boat or whatever, if you forget for a second, it'll remind you why you should.
I think that's a general trend in science. Science is quick to remind you when you're not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about this was your worst moment. What was a good memory or a best moment that you had out on the boat?
I've had just so many. The nice thing about my current lab and our focus on outreach and involving the public is every trip there's someone who's never seen a shark before, often lots of people. We work with a lot of what are called Title I historically underserved schools, and many of those kids, even though they live in Miami, they've never been on a boat. Some of them have never even seen the ocean. So they're very excited. They're very enthusiastic, and it's easy to feed off that energy. Even if for me it's the 50th nurse shark I've caught that year, for one of these kids it's the coolest thing they've ever seen, and they're happy to tell us that. So that's every trip is a little different. Every trip there's working with the students is really nice.
What is the most interesting shark that you have caught or witnessed someone catch, I guess?
I just love a major focus of our lab's research is great hammerhead sharks, which are an IUCN red list endangered species. And they're just amazing. I can't get it's every time I see one, it's just awe inspiring. They're just such a crazy looking animal and they're so powerful, which is actually part of a reason why they're so threatened. Something like a tiger shark, if it gets hooked, it doesn't really react. It just sort of sits there. But a hammerhead goes berserk and can tire itself out and often dies as a result of that. That's part of the reason why recreational fishermen like catching them, because of the so-called fight, which is them putting every ounce of energy they have into not dying and then often doing it so much that they do die. They're just so powerful and they're so crazy looking and so graceful when they move through the water. I love the great hammerheads.
That's cool. Really cool.
Yeah, definitely. Do you have any advice for any current or even future, say, master's or doctoral students in this area?
Take advantage of as many leadership and education opportunities as you can while you're in grad school. Learn a skill. Work with something a little different than maybe what you thought you were going to work with. And if you decide to go back to it, that's what you wanted to do originally, that's fine. But grad school is a great chance to figure out if academia is in fact what you want to do with your life. And if it isn't, that doesn't mean you failed at grad school. It means you learned something important about yourself, and there are many jobs, many careers that can benefit from someone who's had a scientific training in graduate school. So learn as many skills as you can, figure out what you want to do with your life. If at all possible, attend conferences. If at all possible, get experience that will help you in whatever career you want to choose, like leadership experience or what have you, or management experience.
Cool. So one last question, and we've asked this of a lot of our previous guests. Do you have any favorite books that you would recommend to our listeners that are about sharks, or I guess it can be anything that interests you?
Let me just look up the title to make sure that the Bible of the elasmobranch biology world is the Biology of Sharks and Their Relatives series. Which is, it's quite technical, but it's incredibly thorough. And it's reading those series is sort of the equivalent of a college course on shark biology and ecology. So those books are just wonderful, though they are a little jargony and technical. For someone a little younger or a little less technical, the new Smithsonian Animal Answer Guide series is similarly thorough, but it's sort of directed at a younger audience.
Cool. So with that, we'll go ahead and close it out. So we will post all of the links to everything that was mentioned, including the books and David's website and his blog on southernfriedscience.com. We'll include his Twitter. Are you on Facebook as well?
Yes, I have a Facebook fan page, facebook.com/whysharksmatter.
Cool. So we'll include all of that. He's on Twitter as whysharks or at whysharksmatter. And I see you're also on YouTube.
I don't do as much with that anymore.
Okay. Okay, so we'll include links to all of that. If you guys liked what you heard today, please let us know in a review. You can subscribe on iTunes, and we would love if you would do that. We just want to thank you again, David, for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So with that said, we'll talk to you guys later, and we'll catch you next week.
We're done recording now, by the way.
Great.
I think the coolest part for me was when you were talking about the hammerhead shark, I could just tell by the tone of your voice how enthralled you are by all of this.
I've seen dozens of them at this point, and it's every time it's exciting. I've seen thousands of sharks at this point, and I still have the same reaction that I did when I was 3 years old and saw one at the aquarium. It's nice.
Thank you for listening to Stop, Think, Science. We are glad you could join us. Our success depends on you. Please subscribe to our show on iTunes. And if you're feeling generous, leave us a review. If you have comments or questions about anything that you heard today, don't hesitate to drop us a line at our website, www.stopthinkscience.com.